Hello, Margaret Coffey with you for Encounter. This week we meet some of Australia's keenest citizens. As a proportion of applicants, Iraqis are at the top of the list of new Australians. They're one of the smaller groups in Australia, and most of the 14,000 or so have arrived as refugees since the 1991 Gulf War.
But the Kurds are desperate to get down off the mountains. The ridges are crammed with Iraqi citizens whose government has been trying to kill them.
Lots of people, after the Iraqi army entered the cities of the north, a large number of people, probably the whole population of the region, left Iraq to neighboring Iran and Turkey. And I was caught in the mass exodus from the country.
Bad weather, snow, wind and rain has made their lives a misery.
من بغداد
The Iraqis were after me and my family. The reason being, they wanted me to be a spy for the Assyrian Democratic Movement. I refused this, so I knew that they were after me and I will be killed. So I then took my wife and my children and escaped Iraq. An agent assisted us. He took us, me and my wife and my children, and threw us in a mountain. Which mountain, I don't know.
The long trek has taken its toll. Most of the refugees are exhausted.
I walked for about 12 hours crossing the mountains between Iraq and Turkey. After that, we stayed for about 20 days in nowhere. Some of the Kurdish villagers in southern Turkey were generous to allow us to stay with them. There were nights we stayed outside until the Turkish government, with the help of the International Alliance, helped the refugees by establishing the refugee camps. I left the Erbil about a day before the army entered it, so I went further to the north, paying huge sums of money for people to take us from spot to spot until I arrived at the nearest point. We didn't need a guide because the queues of people crossing the borders before us were so long that we could see there were about 2 million people there.
Babies have been most at risk from exposure and starvation.
Some of the peaks were covered with snow even at the northern hemisphere's summer, so you can imagine it's very cold, very, very cold.
Iraqi plains, these people know they're lucky to be alive.
Remember those scenes from the television coverage in 1991? We called them all Kurds, and indeed most of them were. But Iraq is an ethnically complex place, and the great exodus in front of the Iraqi army reflected that complexity.
Can you show me where you came from on this map of Iraq and how you found a route out of the country?
After the Gulf War, there were three ways out of Iraq.
I am originally from a very historic city. It is called Nineveh, the Assyrian city. The main city of this state, Nineveh, is Mosul. So I came from Mosul through to Baghdad, and this is an official route, and then to, of course, the very long journey to Jordan. If you are leaving officially the country, then everybody from any part of Iraq should take this route, because this is the only route after the Gulf War.
That's the route that Saddam Hussein's sons took, wasn't it?
Yes, indeed, yes.
Of the Iraqi people who are settled in Australia, how many would have come through that route?
Very few came through that route. The great majority of people who came to Australia, and indeed to any other part of the world as refugees, took two main routes. Mm-hmm. They are either from the northern part of Iraq, either from Mosul or other parts of Kirkuk, for example, then they went to Kurdistan, and then because this is a no-fly zone governed by, officially by the U.S. and allied forces, then the people can go from there to Turkey, and from Turkey go mostly illegally to Greece, and then from Greece they will apply for humanitarian refugee through United Nations offices.
Nabil Suleiman is an Iraqi member of the Australian Arabic Council. The northern route, he describes, was taken by most of the Iraq-born who have reached Australia, people of Kurdish, Assyrian and Chaldean background who fled the advancing Iraqi army.
So this is one way of getting outside the country. And the other route, which are taken by other people who are from the center and particularly from the southern states, then it will be to Rafha, which is the camp in Saudi Arabia, which is inhabited by the prisoners of war. Although it is called the prisoners of war, they are not the majority are prisoners of war. Prisoners of war plus families who have moved seeking for asylum.
The people who fled south to Saudi Arabia left in the immediate aftermath of the Gulf War, as Hussein's army put down an uprising in the south by Iraq's majority Shia Muslims.
Before that, we escaped from town to town, from house to house. We changed house every few months to stay away from Saddam's eyes and his men. After the revolution, they searching every house, so we must go away from them. That was the real reason to escape. That 10 days was very difficult for me. It was the first time for me to see a lot of bodies, a lot of hurt people. I saw women. She was pregnant 8 months. Cut her stomach from here to here, and her baby's hand was out of that. I saw a lot of things in that way. I saw many of cats and dogs eating our youngest body in the street.
Dead people.
Mm. The armies were laughing on us. They said, no Islam after these days. You must go out, no Islam. You must all die. They write these words on the all of street wall.
Nowadays, Iraq is a multicultural country. If we take the northern part of the country, the Kurdish region, 99% or 100% probably are Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
Within that region, within the Kurdish region, some Christian minorities live scattered in small villages or towns. There are Chaldean towns and or Assyrian towns. Because of the political instability in those parts of the Kurdish region, lots of the Christian population had migrated to larger cities.
To Baghdad, for example.
Well, so they started migration to Mosul, mm-hmm. which is the second largest city in the country, which is the...
In the northwest.
Exactly, which is an Arabic city. And also to places like Kirkuk and Erbil and... Then at later times, a larger scale of migration to Baghdad. The majority of Iraqi's population, as you know, is Muslim population, about 95%. Within this remaining 5% of the other minorities, there are Christians, there are Yazidis, and there are Manda'i, small groups of people who have different faiths.
Tiny number of Jews. Tiny,
a very tiny number of Jews. I haven't met personally one, except I knew there was one or two students in the university. I heard from people saying that there are a countable number of families, of Jewish families, still living in Baghdad.
Why don't you be a Syrian? Sure. Could be Babylonian.
Iraq is much more than Saddam Hussein. Okay. It's the heartland of Western Asia. It means history, diversity, culture, stories that we tell our children.
It's not a very common name in Iraq, but it's not also a rare name. I've heard many people calling their daughters Ishtar. It reminds me of my roots.
Tell me what it comes from.
It means it's the equivalent of Aphrodite in the Greek mythology. In the ancient Babylonian mythology, goddess Ishtar, the mother goddess of love, fertility, is the goddess that the ancient Babylonian kings and warriors used to pray for during their campaigns, war campaigns, to give them the victory.
So you have a daughter called Ishtar.
That's right. I'm Mesopotamian and Iraqi. Mesopotamia is the name the Greek called that part of the world, ancient world, which means the land between two rivers, Tigris and Euphrates. Lots of nations lived in that part of the world, started with the Sumerians and then the Babylonians and the Assyrians and the New Babylonians, who are called in books of history the Chaldeans. So I'm a Chaldean and also a Mesopotamian.
Cameron Abduka, he's a Chaldean, the largest group of Iraq-born people in Australia. In remote, prehistoric times, there was a famous temple of Ishtar in the city of Nineveh, across the river Tigris from the modern city of Mosul.
Chaldeans are a group of people who, under the leadership of King Nebuchadnezzar, established their largest empire in Mesopotamia and also neighboring countries. Like, I think they even reached Egypt at some time. The word Chaldean also is equivalent of astrologer, people who look at the skies and the stars and interpret things. According to the books of history, I think even the division of the year into 12 months is attributed to the Chaldeans.
Centuries before Christ, Nineveh was the capital of the great Assyrian Empire, when Assyria held sway over Egypt. The Babylonians, the first Chaldean dynasty, destroyed it in the year 612 BC. This is how, in the Hebrew Bible, the prophet Nahum foretold the ruin of Nineveh. The crack of whip and rumble of wheel, galloping horse and bounding chariot, horsemen charging, flashing sword and glittering spear, piles of dead, heaps of corpses, dead bodies without end. They stumble over the bodies. In modern times, the word Chaldean has a religious meaning. Chaldeans are Catholics who follow an Eastern rite formally connected with Rome since the 16th century. But they know their roots. Each year, before Lent, they remember the prophet Jonah's tale of the fall of Nineveh with a three-day fast. In English, it's called the Austerity of Nineveh. In Melbourne, the Chaldean community meets at their church, Our Lady, Guardian of the Plants. That's a favourite Chaldean name for Mary. Before the Gulf War, the Iraqi population had no real tradition of migration.
The main migrating groups in Iraq were Chaldeans and the Assyrians. Both Christian groups. Lots of the Chaldeans had settled in the United States, and to my knowledge, there were very, very small number in Melbourne and Sydney. 200, 300 people. That was before 1992. Now, what happened after the events of the Gulf War and the sanctions? Large numbers of people left. The groups that left the country were mainly the Christian groups. During the Gulf crisis, the government's propaganda was to portray the allied troops as the new crusaders to the lands of the Islam. The government did to stir the sensitive religious feelings and to mobilize the forces of the people or the population. During those days, I heard myself things that harmed me as a Christian. During the days of the air raids, people would tell Christians in Iraq who were under the fires of the American or the Allied planes that, look at these, your people, the Christians are bombing us. Majority of the population didn't swallow this propaganda campaign and didn't like it.
The hymns, the readings are in modern Chaldean, but the language of the Chaldean liturgy is ancient Aramaic. The liturgical texts are archaic, different from those used by Western Catholics of the Latin Rite. There are apostles and founding fathers like Saints Adai, Agai and Mari, unfamiliar to Western Christians. And there are signs of insertion in the Arabic world.
The last one was in Arabic. So we learned here. I didn't learn Arabic in my country, in my town, because they all speak Chaldean. But here some people, they speak Arabic, some speak Chaldean. So the people speak Arabic, they don't understand most of the time. So we sing for them in Arabic. Arabic songs, the tone is different from the Chaldean tone. So in the Chaldean, the words are more difficult to pronounce for the singing especially.
Chaldean Christianity is an Eastern rite. Chaldeans belong to the Church of the East, to the strand which is unified with Rome and recognizes the Pope as head of the Church. There's another strand, the Assyrian Church of the East, which stayed away from the Roman connection. It's part of the Orthodox tradition. There are divisions here too. Some Assyrians acknowledge a patriarch in Baghdad. Others recognize a patriarch based in the United States. You have to go way back to the 4th century to arguments about the human nature of Jesus and the fact of Jesus' suffering to find some of the reasons why the Church of the East took its distinctive character. You need to look at the politics of empires as well, the conflict between Constantinople and the Persian Empire. The main players in the long and intense theological argument were Cyril of Alexandria and Nestorius of Constantinople.
The Cold War of the early centuries was between Rome and Persia. The difficulty with any Christian church was that it was seen to be the religion of the Roman Empire, and therefore it was suspect within Persia. Nestorianism, or the Antiochene form of Christianity, I think it's more accurate to say, found a foothold in Persia and had some purchase because it was seen to be precisely different from the form of Christianity which was adopted in Constantinople, the centre of the Roman Empire at the time. The followers of Nestorius were driven out of Antioch and took refuge first of all in Edessa, a city on the edge of Persia, and eventually they found a home inside Persia. It was that form of Christianity that then spread not only through Persia but through the trade routes to India and also up to Samarkand and through Samarkand to China. So the story of the subsequent spread of Nestorian Christianity, which was undergoing great persecutions from time to time within Persia itself, is really one of the great, hardly told and virtually known stories of Christianity.
Theologian Andrew Hamilton, he's written about the construction of Christian heretics, such as Nestorius, in the theological journal Pacifica. Modern so-called Nestorians, who are by no means heretical, are among the Iraq-born people in Australia.
My name is Wilson Kendo. I'm the spokesman of the Assyrian Victorian Council. We're not asking for Iraq to be divided now. All we're saying, we want to live like a human being, not to be treated like fourth or fifth class citizen of Iraq. We were born there, we served in the armies, we fought their wars, we fought their even dirty wars. Because we belong to that country. Any opportunity for them there to get rid of the Assyrians, they've done it. Give you an example. In 1988, everybody in this country or the Western countries hear about Iraqi regime has bombed and gassed and used chemicals on a part of Kurdistan. There were two Assyrian villages. Same thing, same kind of weapon being used on them. There were thousands of Assyrians massacred. Nobody mentioned about them. Nobody talked about them. For some reasons, all we talk about Kurdistan. It seems like the numbers.
The Sunday liturgy is long. The priest is a refugee too. His daughter leads the responses. They borrow a uniting church each week and run a Syrian Sunday school for the children. While the liturgy goes on, I'm listening to stories. This man was a conscript in the Iraqi army during the 1980s Iran-Iraq war. He spent 8.5 years in an Iranian prison. When he returned to his hometown, they'd given him up for dead, and another war had broken out.
After I came back from Mosul, I found out that my brother had been killed, I had relatives, their leg were amputated, they had been tortured.
وغزالي ظروف تامة ولا بلاشت عراق وكويت خاقة خيتا.
There was a war of Iraq and Kuwait again.
وبلاشة مزديان ورابة نكي سوري توي بنون تخوني فيشي وتام ويمي.
And the war was very frightening, to be quite honest with you. My nieces and nephews were in Iraq and my brother as well. So.
بيدن تام زيلي لأردن.
So from there I fled to Jordan.
In Jordan, he sent for money to American relatives and with dollars in hand returned to collect his five nephews and nieces. He escaped again on foot with the children over the mountains into Turkey.
My brother and his wife at the moment, currently they are held by the Jordanian authorities in jail. They are. I sent some money to release them on bail. They've given 10 days to leave Jordan. And if they don't pay this money, they are then returned back to Iraq. I borrowed $10,000 from here to send it to them so they can be released on bail at least.
I don't know.
Where they'll go, I don't know.
Shukran.
Thank you
very much.
I was soldier between Baghdad and Basra. When the Americans shoot the army, the army is finished all.
This man shakes uncontrollably as he talks. He remembers not knowing who to trust. As the soldiers retreated from the Americans, they ran into the Shiite uprising in the south. When he made it to the north, to Kurdistan, to extract his family from the midst of the Kurdish revolt, he was shot by Iraqi soldiers. He hung on to his machine gun until he and his family made it to Turkey.
Every day, the government, they come to ask my parents, where your son, where you go, what he do. Now my parents, they left to Jordan. We make the application for them, but nothing to give him the chance to come in here. Maybe last week I went to immigration in Dandenong. I asked about my parents. I don't know, every day when I go, they tell me next month, this nearly 2 years. When I go there, they tell me, wait, I don't know why.
The courage, tenacity and resourcefulness of these people are overwhelming. Every Iraq-born refugee has a terrible story to tell, but they do not tell them in community. It's not possible to speak even of the recently arrived Iraq-born as a community.
Definitely there is a lot of mistrust. I don't know how to explain it to you further, but we always claim in Iraq or anywhere that we are a Syrian first. I don't mean first that we are priority, but if you ask me what I am, today I can tell you I'm an Assyrian Australian or I'm Australian Assyrian. In Iraq, I'll say the same. We are an Assyrian Iraqis, but they do not want us to mention the word Assyrian. They just want to abolish it, demolish the name. That's why some people there, they are happy with that sentiment. They call themselves Arab Christians or Arab Iraqis. How can we trust them here?
In their separate, religiously and ethnically defined groups, Iraqi refugees are worrying about the same things. Finding jobs, educating children, rescuing family members from the limbo of refugee camps or the danger of deportation back to Iraq, supporting family still inside Iraq.
Me and everybody else is trying very hard to help the family, because even if you don't want to help them, every letter there are people who are asking you, please send us anything you have. We are in desperate situation. And desperate is a real situation. But of course, as you know here as well, life is just adequate. There is really no extra money. There is no much saving to send to for yourself and for your family back home. But despite this, they are the priority, because their priority means food. My priority means more luxurious items.
Everyone, says Nabil Suleiman, is worried about the people they have left behind. No one who has come from Iraq wants sanctions, no matter how fiercely they oppose the regime. This woman saw the effect of sanctions as a doctor in a hospital.
It affects only our people. Even the treatment is very difficult for them. When I work in my hospital, I wrote the prescription for the patients for treatment, but they couldn't find it, the treatment. So it's become so expensive for them. So my job become a stress. I'm anxious all the time because I couldn't help my patients. Even during the work in the hospital as a gynecologist, well, I see the patient, sometimes patient need operation for her to do operation. I bring her to the theater, but unfortunately I found no stitches for to do the operation. There's no antiseptic uses for them. So believe me, I use water. I see the patients sometimes die because they're seeing the operation. I couldn't help her. So go, no, how can I do the operation? So the baby inside her abdomen might maybe die, and I'm sitting beside her. What can I do? I couldn't help her. I'm happy to leave Iraq, believe me. We live with Saddam Hussein. It is not alive. It is dead here, believe me. The people here are dead, not alive.
There is a move toward building an Iraqi community in Melbourne. Nabil Suleiman is one of the people making the move, and so is Ghanem Al-Makboudi.
If you ask any Iraqi now, people feel they need some kind of gathering, first of all, to unify them, and in the same time to work within Australian society to show their problem and explain to the Australian media, for example, what is actually the problem of Iraq and Iraqi people, why so many Iraqi coming to Australia and everywhere in the world under the cover of humanitarian ground, for example. Not many people understand what's going on, and many people, they don't know even what is Iraq and where it is situated. For me, if you talk about my opinion, is the purpose is to integrate this community within Australian society and help the community to integrate within Australian society, because once they are here, in my opinion, is they are Australian first of Iraqi origin.
Ghanem Al-Makboudi is not a refugee. His great good luck was to leave Iraq as a PhD student in 1980, before the Iran-Iraq war, and to come to Australia at the offer of a university position.
We have to understand Australia is not simply shelter. It is true that we come under humanitarian cover, but still Australia is a nice country, and we have to integrate and work and give maximum of our input to this society. If we focus on we are Shiite or we are Sunni or we are Kurd, what's the point behind this? I don't think we have such kind of organization even in our homeland, first country, Iraq. So why when we come here?
What do people fear about such an organization? I'm curious about this because many people have said to me they're not interested in an organization which has political overtones. And very many people I've spoken to have also been frightened of giving details, for example, about how they left the country. There's a sense that they're being observed, watched, or somehow that if they lend themselves to liaisons with particular people, that they're becoming political in ways that they don't want to.
That's right. As I said, the Iraqi, most of them, if not all, under shock, and they are depressed from anything, remind them of politics, party. I think the reason behind this is not simply the terrible experience that the old Iraqi had because of the actual regime, but I think they don't understand or they can't differentiate between politics in terms of a way of build up a country for the prosperity, for the democracy. And politics, as we have it, is simply kind of suppression, control of the country or the nation. We need to know politics is everything in life. I'm not involved in political party, but I cannot talk about Iraqi tragedy right now if I don't talk about politics. I can't talk about, for example, religion. What's the difference between Shiite and Sunni? It is started as politics. Who will succeed the Prophet? who will form the government, and that is politics.
In Iraq, the official religion is Islam. The majority, 60%, are Shiite Muslims, the rest mainly Sunni. Nabil Suleiman comes from the north of Iraq, but he is Shia.
I really don't like to distinct between Shia and Sunni. To me, is the same because they are governed by the same core religion will apply on Sunni and Shiite. Like some of the extremist people who really put these differences, to me, it is not different whether you are Sunni or Shiite, you are Muslim, and that's it.
When you ask people Shiite or Sunni, many people, they don't like that question because they think that makes differences between Iraq. For me, I admit the reality and I admit the truth. And I say, if you ask me, are Shiite? I am Shiite. Nothing wrong with that. Like Sunni people, like Armenian people, like Christian, like I am Shiite. I don't hide my religion or my sect. Or if we make this problem and we are cautious to talk about it, then we are not tackling the main problem. You see what I mean? It's like someone, he wants to have a solution without talking about a problem. So yes, I am Shiite. What's wrong with that? Now, maybe other people will understand that, oh yes, he claim it as he's Shiite, so he distinguish between Shiite. Not necessarily. I'm not distinguishing, I'm not saying I am correct and others wrong. No.
A fifth of the Iraq-born people in Australia are Muslim. Most of them recent refugees and Shia. People who fled when the uprising in the south against Saddam Hussein after the Gulf War was crushed. The regime's gunships and tanks devastated the south and its beautiful cities, Najaf and Karbala.
Me and my husband and my two and other children every day to the roof center to do prayer.
Every day you go?
Yeah, every day. 7 a.m. Me and my husband and another people also, we found them there, do our prayer, and after 1 hour we return back to our home. Here is 3 years, very good. We find our freedom to do our prayer and in a free way. It's not like in Iraq. Even it's more than 90% of them as Muslims, but one cannot do his prayer in such a way with the freedom.
Ghanem al-Makboudi says Iraqi refugees are in shock. The stories of the Shiite refugees are testimony to this. This woman spends her days studying for admission to medical practice.
I graduated in 1989 in Iraq as the first medical doctor. Then I start after 2 years in higher studies in gynecology. Unfortunately, after it remained only 1 year to take the degree of higher study as a gynecologist. I leave Iraq because of Saddam Hussein. Because when the revolution against Saddam start after the war of Gulf War, we participate, me and my husband, also my husband as doctor, participate in the treatment of the people who come against Saddam Hussein. From the start, I made a decision to treat every people involved in the revolution because I hate Saddam Hussein. I said to all the doctors to come and say no against Saddam Hussein. I told them this is the time come to say no. All the time they obey his laws, his regime. But I said to them, no. So many who obey the law register my name. So we leave everything, our families, our jobs, our studies, and migrate to Iran through the marshes. It takes about 4 days in the marshes and in the winter. And at that time, I have only one child, which is my daughter. At that time, her age, only 1 month. And we migrate walking 4 days through the marshes, and that is running days, so we keep our daughter in the bags. I'm not breastfeeding her because at that time I'm continue my job in Iraq in the hospital. So I put her on bottle feed. And when we migrate, the problem here, and there is no sterile water to put it in the bottle for feeding her. So I used dirty water in the marshes and put it in the bottle and put a mold for her. So after 2-3 days, she start diarrhea, and her condition become very bad. I tell her that God need you to live again.
The marshes have gone, and so have the marsh Arabs. The Iraqi regime drained and poisoned the marshes, and their people were killed or forced to flee to Iran.
My name is Ferian, and 39 years old. I'm from Iraq. I have 6 kids. I think it's difficult for us to explain the situation about Saddam and his personality, because criminal personality he has.
This woman had 2 brothers. At the outbreak of the Iran-Iraq war, they were arrested and hung. They were 16 and 19.
At the beginning of the war between Iraq and Iran, we imprisoned me and my husband's family. I stayed in the prison 1 year. 1 year after I finished the college, the agricultural university. I asked about the reason, with many sufferings and without eating, without seeing anybody, and in one room they present me. They said the reason that we put you there here, you are telling the students that teaching them Islam and teaching them how to wear the scarf. This is the reason. I said, why it should be this? It should be a reason for arresting me. We are all Islam. They said, no, your Islam is different. We want the other Islam. I had my first baby, 16 years old, the son there in the prison. I stayed there with my baby 6 months. After that, I came out of the prison. I saw no family, no husband, no anyone. I couldn't stay with anyone because we can't depend on them. We can't trust them. From all the people, they make a sort of situation that nobody can accept you as a visitor because they afraid. His regime used to give money and kill. Killing and giving money. I had my 5 kids, all without my husband. 3 times they arrested him and let him out until we escaped. My little boys, the youngest, they were just 3 years old. We stayed 10 days hiding us. Ourselves under the roof, under the stairs from the bombs which Saddam bombed us and destroyed our house. He threw something that make light. I don't know what you call it. Like a weapon and make light in the sky to show everything clear. They use it in the war. It caused a fire around us. And in the middle of the night, we carried our kids without clothes, without, they were sleeping because they were so tired from that. Just we carried them and go out of that area because all the area fired. So it was a beautiful story for them. They never forgot this story. They stayed until many months in Iran when we went there, asking their father every night to tell them that story. How did we escape? How did we went there out of our home in the jungle and in the beach, eating anything, seeing many people with their loading, some of them carrying babies. It was a story for them, but I think it will not they will not forget it. It will be in their mind, in their future, in their living. Yesterday was their birthday, my twins. Their teacher, he sent for them a card, putting the Saddam's picture inside the card. Really, he's just joking with them because he knew about them and their story. Put Saddam's card. I will show you. He wrote from Saddam to Ahmad and Muhammad for joking.
Iraq-born people in Australia are a rich mix. Perhaps the earliest Iraqis to arrive were the Sephardi Jews who came as post-World War II refugees. There are Chaldeans, Assyrians and Muslims. There's even a group of Mandaeans. Theirs is a tiny Gnostic sect. With all the suffering they share, there's room for pride.
In my opinion, if we have something to be proud of, I can make it in three categories. One is Iraqi people diversity. See, for example, Australian people. They are happy, they are proud of the successful system, multiculturalism. And it is amazing when you think about it that a society like Iraq, based on multiculturalism thousands of years ago, I think that makes me proud. How Arab, Assyrian, Armenian, Persian, Turkish, all those people living in one piece of land together. Well, Muslims, Christian, Jewish, Yazidi, Sabi'i, Mandarin. So that's something I am proud of. Second is, which is consequent to this, is the huge accumulation of culture. The third thing is the geographic situation. Iraq is an Arabic country, yes. But Iraq has a border with well-established old civilization, the Persian, the Turkish, the Greek, and the Indian. So this kind of link between Iraq and all these civilizations makes Iraq really rich in terms of culture. I am proud of Iraq because of this. We should not exaggerate when we said we are Assyrian. Yes, we are Assyrian, but we are part of that society. It's not simply Arab, it's not simply Kurd, it's not simply Assyrian, it's all together. That's what I'm proud of. If I can add just at the end, I think I have to. What led to the tragedy of Iraq is, one way or others, is all these three elements being destroyed. And that's what makes Iraq tragedy really high scale. Is oppression against minorities and politics against any power facing government, whether it is Shiite, whether it is Kurd, whether it is Muslim, no matter how. And then we destroy. This kind of diversity is destroyed. Now, the culture, it's become monotony. And then look at the problem with neighboring countries. It's exceptional when you see Iraq has no friend around him. That's what makes me really feel bad, because all what I can be proud of is destroyed.
Ghanem al-Makbudi. And for Nabil Suleiman, there are hard-won values to be passed on to the next generation.
I like my children to follow my religion, but I like them to be very, very broad-minded, not only in religion, but in any other facet of life. I would like them to be very broad-minded in accepting all different people as people. They should judge the other person as he or she is, not as other religion or other ethnic background or other color or other political parties or whatever. I want them to be the broadest possible mind on earth. because I think after the suffering of the Iraqi people, they should understand that the only way to combat the suffering is to be very open-minded to everybody, to every civilization, to every culture, to every ethnic background, to religion, so that people should live the very peaceful life that we in the Iraq were deprived of it. There is no peace at all. Look, for the last, 8 years, Iraq-Iran war, and then after 8 years, this is another 8 years, so 16 years. So you could imagine a baby who was born 16 years ago, until now, he couldn't feel safe in his own country, in his own family, in his own room. He couldn't feel safe. So after deprivation of safety and security, I think one should realize the importance of accepting each other and how to live in peace.
The last lines of Nahum's prophecy in the Hebrew Bible go like this. Your shepherds are asleep, O kings of Assyria. Your people are scattered on the mountains with no one to gather them. There is no assuaging your hurt. Your wound is mortal. All who hear the news about you clap their hands over you. For who has ever escaped your endless cruelty? Thank you to all the people who so kindly agreed to be part of this program. Tapes are available at a cost of $25. Write to ABC Radio Tapes, Box 994, GPO Sydney, 2001. Technical production, Russell Thompson. I'm Margaret Coffey.